forgotten lore.
That is recording.
Okay. That is a recorder.
Hot cross buns.
Recorders have to be the most annoying instrument. Are they still doing the recorder, Riley?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh my god, that's awful. I hate it.
You know what? I think at the time it was fine, but I can only feel for all the music teachers in the world that have to suffer through a bunch of grade 4 and 5 kids like playing the recorder for the first time.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, my elementary school music teachers, we had 2 of them, and they were both equally awful, and it was probably because of years of listening to children play recorders and poorly.
Yeah, it must breed cynicism, like
turn you into a monster.
I'm sure it does. Yeah. Well, one of them like publicly shamed you for being colorblind.
Yeah, she did.
Yeah.
Fucking bitch.
Fucking loser.
Mrs. Stewart, she looked like the fucking crypt keeper.
Hi, Mrs. Stewart.
If you're listening to this, fuck you.
My music teacher in elementary school was lovely, and she
she like new to the
yeah she was actually she was like a new to the school.
That's why.
Yeah, the year, I'm pretty sure that the year that we started recorder, I think it was her first year, which is funny.
Yeah. She hasn't been broken yet.
No, she was still unjaded, untainted by that world. Yeah.
Well, with all that said, we're gonna get the show going. This is Forgotten Lore. I'm Kevin.
I'm Riley.
And I'm Ainsley.
And today on the show, we are concluding our series explaining the events depicted in the Magic the Gathering novel Plane Shift. Last episode, we were planning to conclude it, but we didn't. So this is the conclusion, part two. So in the conclusion part one, we covered the hashtag Dragon Nation's quest to free the primevals, as well as Weatherlight facing off against the Phyrexian skyship Predator. You guys remember Predator from Wrath and Storm?
How could I forget?
Yeah, that's a good one. I had to turn the brightness down on this. Ainsley and I are sitting in like the dark down here, so
it's very romantic.
Yeah, we need some candles. So with the death of also, at the end of the last episode, remember that Lord Grizzlegome, at Agnate's behest,
it's pretty silly,
killed him, and then killed him again, killed his undead self, killed him twice.
Yeah.
So, with the death of the only Metathoran commander, control of the army fell to Grizzlegom and Elidomri, of course, if he was ever going to show up there. And Urborg, of course. We're still in Urborg. So, Grizzlegom emerged from the tent and commanded 2 Metathoran to stand guard, as he did not want Lord Drownew to discover what he had done until Grizzlegom had rallied his forces against the undead. There were several Metathran gathered outside the tent, and he showed them the note from Agnate with the commander's seal in wax. So yeah, Agnate, I don't know if you mentioned it in the last episode, but Agnate had like a ring with like a seal on it, and then anytime he was like, you know, giving a real deal order that he wasn't giving himself, he would, you know, write it down and then seal it with his ring.
Cute.
Like a stamp.
I love cute stationery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a wax seal is really classy.
Mm-hmm.
So thankfully, the Metathran believed the Minotaur, and they led him to another command tent where they found General Rilgesh, a Metathran second only to Agnate and Thaddeus, which is funny because he's like a general, which I think is a higher rank than commander, but whatever. So they discussed Agnate's death and the fact that he had passed command of the army over to the Minotaur, and again, Rilgesh believed him. It's pretty, I like that name. If we have any more kids, I think that should be a contender.
It's not happening.
With, With their alliance certified, they began to plan their next move, which was to deal with Drownu and his undead army. And wouldn't you know it, just then the Lich Lord arrived outside Rilgesh's tent, and by that point, Drownu had discovered the corpse of Agnate and had killed both Metathran guards to get to the body. And I can't tell you what he did to the body.
Please don't.
No, I'm kidding. That's a joke. He didn't do any... Well, they don't say.
Of course they don't say. Is this like a YA novel?
Let your imagination run.
One wild. It's going to one wild.
And YAs have great imaginations.
Yes, they do. They don't need to have as much imagination these days as we had to have back in the day. But
they're just as horny.
It's true.
Yeah, if not more. So, with Drownu's arrival, those inside the command tent exited to meet the Lich Lord. Drownu demanded an explanation for Agnate, and Grizzlegom told him the truth, and he also told him that he suspected that the Lich Lord was responsible for the plague that nearly killed Agnate. Drownu denied the accusations, but accepted that the Metathran army was under Grizzlegom's control. Then, with the help of his gathered men, Grizzlegom impaled Drownu with sword and horn. As they did so, they found dozens of gems in his belly, and the gems spilled forth.
Oh, that's kind of fun, like a little pinata.
yeah, it is a lot like a gemmy pinata.
all the creatures just scramble to pick up all the gems.
Gimme! And the gems actually contained Lord Drownu's essence, and they would each one could bring him back from the dead over and over again, as opposed to like a regular undead where you kill them once they're done. But I guess if you, it's almost like a Horcrux when you think about it. Grizzlegom knew this about liches, so he made sure each gem was shattered to dust, making sure Drownu could never return. Can you imagine that? You break open a pinata and all the candy just gets crushed.
Really. Sorry, kids. We got to destroy it.
Yeah. They're Horcruxes. You get it. So RIP Drownu again.
Oh, my God. Bye.
So in removing Drownu from the equation, the coalition army solved one problem but created another. With the undead army leaderless, they once again became mindless ghouls. So with their combined strength, Metathran and Minotaur spent the following few days exterminating the undead from Urborg. So while events unfolded in Urborg, Urza continued to descend deeper into Phyrexia with his five remaining titans. By that point, they battled gargantuan machines on the fourth sphere. And as they fought, Urza marveled at what he saw, what Yawgmoth had created. The Planeswalker had always been somewhat in awe of the artificial world, but at that point, so close to destroying it, he was becoming more enamored with Phyrexia, a fact that he did not share with his fellow Planeswalkers. Something else that Urza did not share with his comrades was that he was becoming paranoid of them, paranoid that they were beginning to turn on him. It was at that point that Urza decided that he and he alone would descend into the ninth sphere. And now it's unclear if the feeling Urza was having was due to some kind of mind intrusion by Yawgmoth, or if Urza had always felt this way about Phyrexia and was just then realizing it. But as it often happens, it's probably a little bit of both. In either case, Urza ordered his planeswalkers to plant one of the soul bombs and descended to the sixth sphere of Phyrexia. It's getting hot. So, the sixth sphere was covered in tall grass made of metal. Urza waded through it in his Titan suit, carrying the final soul bomb, the one that, when detonated, would trigger the others. To the planeswalker, the bomb was the only ugly creation on the beautiful sphere, and that's when he decided he could not destroy Phyrexia, that it was a masterpiece created by a visionary.
Ooh.
Yeah, Urza's gonna turn traitor.
Who could have seen that coming?
Urza? No.
He's such an upstanding guy.
Yeah, he is. So Urza placed the bomb on the ground and began ripping the wire from it, essentially deactivating it. That's when another Titan suit shimmered into being. The multicolored form of Taser immediately demanded to know what Urza was doing. That's when Urza heard a voice inside his head, a voice he had not heard in millennia. And I don't know if this is Yawgmoth, but we're just going to pretend that we're just going to say it is Yawgmoth, because there's lots of stuff going on in this plane. This is also the plane where Yawgmoth's inner circle hangs out. So I don't know. It could be anyone, but let's just say it's Yawgmoth.
Welcome home, Urza. Welcome home.
I don't know why he's so gravelly.
Because he's daddy. He's Yawgmoth's daddy.
Yeah. Yawgmoth's like, light it up. Actually, no, he'd probably say, don't light it up because it's a bomb. Don't light it up.
Oh, God.
Then thousands of metal creatures swarm Taser's suits, tearing it apart. Instead of fighting them off, Taser focused on Urza, explaining that they could still use one of the other bombs as the main ignition, that they could still destroy Phyrexia. I guess that was the last straw for Urza, because at that suggestion, he activated the kill rubric in Taser's suit, ending the Planeswalker's long life.
Jeez.
Yeah, got him. Urza had not planned for betrayal from Taser, and that's when he remembered the four other walkers. They would probably still attempt to detonate the remaining bombs. But he heard the voice again. What were you trying to prove?
No.
They are no longer your concern. Leave them to my minions. You must ascend toward me. Leave your Titan engine here and come to the seventh sphere.
It's very queer.
The seventh sphere is a place of torments. Why do you call me to the seventh sphere? Have I failed you?
There is a final test you must pass, Urza Planeswalker. I must know your true heart.
Sorry. You... Mr. Planeswalker.
That's Mr. Planeswalker to you.
Yeah.
You will know it.
How does that feel?
Are you laughing at my voice?
No, I'm just having a good time.
Okay, you better be.
Then Urza planeswalked from the piloting bulb of his Titan suit and traveled to the seventh sphere, leaving his Titan as a gift for Yawgmoth.
Oh, that's nice. Little gifty poo.
So has anyone watched the latest season of 1,000-Pound Sisters?
Oh my God, no.
Okay, well, it's...
Only you and your friend from work have watched that show.
Evidently.
Yeah.
No one else seems to want to talk about it.
No. We don't want to talk about it.
What is 1,000-Pound Sisters?
So there's two sisters from Kentucky, and together at the start of the show, they weighed like 1,000 pounds. And so it's just like a reality show about their, you know, struggles with weight and intelligence.
In total, they weighed 1,000 pounds?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. There's one that's like bigger, and then one of them like loses enough weight to get like bariatric surgery, and then the other one's like trying to lose weight, but she can't lose weight because she's not really trying to lose weight. Okay. Yeah. And they're like really stupid, and like, you know, even if they were thin, they wouldn't be very good looking.
Oh my God, Kevin.
So they just like have a lot of problems beside the weight. The weight really isn't the issue. Their real problems could never be solved.
Jesus. That is the end.
And so it's just like, so if you're ever feeling like, man, I have some problems. That's the moral of the show.
Yeah.
You watch an episode of that and you're going to feel a whole lot better about yourself.
Every once in a while when Kevin's watching it, he'll like either giggle madly or I'll hear him yell something like, that's why you don't give Mountain Dew to a toddler or something like that. It's...
At least water it down. You know?
Well, there's caffeine in Mountain Dew.
Where do you watch it?
You can watch full episodes of it on like TLC. All those TLC shows you can. Yeah. But that's where I watch it, but it's on TLC.
The
Learning Channel. Yeah, I watch it on YouTube. Sorry.
All right.
Yeah, but it's quality programming.
Yeah, it's the Learning Channel. Yeah. Learn about other people's lives.
It's like, so this is what people from Kentucky are like. I always wondered.
Hi, listeners from Kentucky.
Okay, so getting back to the story here. Urza rematerialized on the next sphere. Just over his head rolled enormous grinders. just over his head rolled enormous grinders studded with diamond teeth. Were he to reach up, his hand would be caught and his whole body ripped away. He looked at the ground. It was covered with bodies. This was no random carnage, but a calculated thing. Creatures were laid out on their backs. Their legs and arms were bolted to pipes. Some were human, some elf, some minotaur or dwarf, but most were Phyrexian. Their feet and kneecaps had been ground away. Their bellies had been ripped open by the diamond points. Their faces were gone. It was a horrid death to have suffered, but fitting for those who had failed the Lord of Phyrexia. Urza looked out at the expanse that was the seventh sphere. He watched as new bodies, living bodies, were ground down as they jiggled in agony. He wondered if this was the test. If it was, it did nothing to shake his newfound belief in Yawgmoth. Urza had long since passed beyond the perception of morality. He had watched those closest to him ground down by existence. Watching creatures he never knew suffer the same fate had no effect on him. Then Urza heard the voice again. It beckoned to him.
Proceed.
He did not. I did not. No, just kidding. He did. He strode through the mass of bodies until Yawgmoth commanded him to stop. Mid-stride, Urza set his foot down beside a Phyrexian.
Look at him! No, I'm kidding. It's more like, look at him. But I liked the first one.
Yeah. Urza did. I did not.
And on the third day, Yawgmoth said, look at him, and Urza did.
I did not. Unlike so many others, this creature's head had not been held down. He could turn it to the side when the rollers came down. Both of his ears were gone, though. The skin and muscle on either side of his head were mere tatters over bone, but his face remained. Black hair, a rumpled brow, sharp eyes, a prominent nose, a mustache, a goatee. It was a familiar face. Even after eons, it took Urza only a moment to recall it.
Mishra.
Oh.
No, it's actually Retepe. You guys remember Retepe?
Retepe.
Yeah. That's a deep cut. No, no, I'm kidding about the Retepe thing. It's just fun to say that word. So, when last he saw his brother, Urza had discovered that Mishra had become a Phyrexian. This realization had led Urza to release the Silex Blast, ending the Brothers' War, starting the Ice Age, and igniting his own Planeswalker spark. He had thought his brother dead, but it seemed that Yawgmoth had returned him to Phyrexia after the war and tortured him for the past 4,000 years. It's pretty rough.
That's a long time.
You're telling me. What was left of Mishra begged Urza to free him, to save him, but again Urza was unmoved by his devotion to the masterpiece that was Phyrexia. It wasn't so much that Urza was no longer interested in saving Dominaria, but more that he needed to know the secrets of how Yawgmoth had created Phyrexia, how he'd created living machines. In his heart of hearts, the Planeswalker was an artificer, and he needed to learn Yawgmoth's secrets. And then he would get him, maybe, I don't know. Having passed Yawgmoth's test, Urza strode away from his brother and descended further, which brings us back to Urborg, the stronghold, to be precise.
Ooh, okay.
When Gerard arrived, all four of Urte's Phyrexian arms held him implacably.
Oh, no plaque.
For you know what? Or were we talking about that before the show? I can't remember. He quickly realized that he'd been teleported to Krovax's throne room. As his eyes adjusted, he assessed the situation. Huge stalactites with impaled bodies dripping blood that huge devil dogs lapped up while Ilvet guards watched with mute disinterest. The centerpiece of the room was an enormous throne carved of black basalt, carved with a riot of tortured figures. Ensconced in their midst was the tormentor himself, Krovax. Their eyes met and the Evankar welcomed his former commander. That's when Gerard noticed Squee bobbing around nearby. In an act of courage, the goblin had jumped onto Urte just before he teleported off Weatherlight to their current location. Anyway, the two former comrades caught up, and if you want to know more about what's occurred since last they met, go back and listen to our series on the Mercadian Masks cycle of novels. With that out of the way, Krovax, face-to-face with his prisoner, explained why he had orchestrated Gerard's capture at the cost of Predator. You're like, is this Retepe?
Oh, sorry, is it me?
Yeah, you gotta do Retepe again.
What?
Don't you see? We are bonded, Gerard. We are brothers.
Hey, brother.
What are you talking about?
Gerard hissed. He turned his face away from the putrid breath. Riley, you gotta hiss.
Riley is like,
sorry.
He's like,
throw it off.
Volrath was my brother.
By adoption only. You and I have the same true parents.
You're my dad.
Yog daddy.
Yeah. He's the daddy. Okay. I'll try again.
By adoption only. You and I have the same true parents, Urza and Yawgmoth.
Krovac stared and hissed into Gerard's eyes.
Urza always doted on you, brother, and Yawgmoth on me, but they both made us.
Oh my god.
This is, yeah.
They are... They are daddy and mommy.
Mommy.
You came from his experiments and I came from Yawgmoth's. Both of us fought for our creators. Both of us sacrificed our one love.
Yeah.
So okay. Which...
That's why I put that. That's why I put it here.
Which one's daddy and which one's mommy?
I don't know.
I like to... Daddy is daddy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got to be Yog Daddy and then Ursa Mommy.
Yeah.
I didn't sacrifice Hannah.
Gerard hissed. That's when Squee voiced his opinion, reminding those in the room that Krovac had actually killed his beloved. At the interruption, Krovac ordered some nearby Mogs to kill Squee, and so they did, by breaking his neck. Then Squee's lifeless body fell to the throne room floor. R.I.P. Squee.
Oh my god.
Well, yeah. He's immortal, right?
No, he's dead. Moving on. At that point, Krovac explained what all this had been for. We already know that it was so Yawgmoth would return Selenia to him, so they may live happily ever after. He also mentioned that if Gerard played his cards right, Yawgmoth could return Hannah to him.
Oh my god.
Having said that, Krovac approached the portal he'd used to communicate with the Ineffable and his inner circle and conveyed a message.
Great Yawgmoth, Daddy. I have brought him as you commanded. I have captured Gerard for you and slain one of his crew. I offer them to you now. Let this complete my sacrifice. Release her soul to me, or if you will not, at least send her in solid form. That I may display your power.
Just give me.
I just do things to her.
I need a solid form, dude.
Oh my god, Krovac is such a fucking freak.
Yep.
He's like, oh yeah, let me have tea with the corpses of my dead parents and
skeletons.
Oh, yeah.
Gerard watched as the angel's body formed from nothing, solidly formed. That is. She approached Krovac, embraced him, and the two kissed. And in the novel, this kiss is described as pathetic on Krovac's part because his shark teeth did not allow his mouth to fully close. So he was kind of kissing with his teeth.
Ugh. Yeah.
Can you imagine just like having your teeth bared and you're just kind of like jamming on somebody's lips? That's not...
That doesn't sound fun. No.
No. It's bad.
It's bad.
So Gerard explained to Krovac that Selenia was dead and the creature that embraced him was possibly an illusion conjured by Yawgmoth, but Krovac ordered the Dark Angel to touch Gerard so he could see for himself.
Oh my god.
Gerard's like, pinch me, somebody. She strode across the room and ran one hand over his black beard. Gerard realized that if she was an illusion, she felt more alive than the man that still held him in place. Remember Urte's still holding him? In spite of this, Gerard said, hissed, that is.
Krovac, Yawgmoth doesn't have dominion over the dead. He is not Lord of Souls. He could not return your lost love to you.
Show him.
Light it up.
I know, I'm kind of mixing their voices together, but they're both like baddies. So they both have to have a baddie voice.
Gerard's eyes were drawn to the gathered mogs that had slain Squee. In their midst, his body shuddered, the green tissues of his neck compacted. Beneath them, fragments of bone slid together to assemble knobby vertebrae. The spinal cord fused again, fingers convulsed with life, toes curled and uncurled, knees drew up beneath an aching body. Elbows trembled as arms pushed the figure upright. Squee's brown vest expanded with breath. He looked up, blinking. Gerard wouldn't have believed it until he heard the goblin speak, but when he did, he knew that even Yawgmoth couldn't replicate his ridiculous speech pattern. Then Krovax explained that Yawgmoth had Hannah and could bring her back to life just as easily. So Squee's not dead, everybody. Riley's right. He's immortal.
Hell yeah.
Riley's right. Once again.
Gerard, understandably upset, and with Squee's help, finally broke free of Erte's grasp. He fell to the ground of the throne room with Squee, while Squee climbed up the front of Erte's body and quickly mounted himself on the wizard's back. He then pounded the head of Erte's mimetic spine, which caused Erte to convulse, while Squee told Gerard to run for it. Instead of running, though, Gerard challenged Krovax to a good old-fashioned fight. And so they did. Krovax using his command over the flowstone, while Gerard used his natural fighting skills to avoid said flowstone. While they fought, Squee continued to wail on Erte's spine, and as he did, the wizard began to release random lethal spells from his hands, many of which killed the mogs that were attempting to remove Squee from Erte's back. As their fight continued, they argued over Yawgmoth's true power and his ability to bring Hannah back to life. Then, just as suddenly as the fight had begun, it was over. Krovax had imprisoned Gerard in a cage of flowstone. At the same time, Squee's fight came to a horrible end. Having shaken the goblin off his back loose enough, Erte grabbed him by one leg and swung his body toward the floor, his head arcing as a mace. When Skull met floor, it cracked open and the content spilled forth and spread across the floor. Erte left his body where it lay. R.I.P. Squee.
Stop it.
He's dead.
Again.
With relative order returned to the throne room, Krovax directed Gerard's gaze to the communications portal. Through it, Gerard could see Urza in a deep sphere of Phyrexia, perhaps the deepest. Deeper. The planeswalker was no longer in his titan suit. He was in some kind of coliseum, surrounded by all manner of hand-to-hand weapons. Krovax explained that even Urza was, at that point, in Yawgmoth's grip. Krovax explained that they had done nothing to Urza to make him see the majesty that Yawgmoth offered, and once Gerard saw what Yawgmoth could do for him, he would see the light as well. Then Gerard saw another figure in the portal. It was Hannah, and she begged Gerard to take them both away from Phyrexia and the stronghold. Gerard was lost in her gaze, and Krovax said, "Do it."
Pretty much.
"You can return to her. You can have her back. You can hold her in your arms again."
He lifted the flowstone cage and hissed.
"All you must do is step through. Take her hand. Know that she is real. Walk with her to the dais, and there, beside Urza, bow to our Lord Yawgmoth. Then she will be yours."
He's like, "You think what I'm thinking? Like, solid form? Oh, yeah."
Yeah.
So Gerard walked toward the portal. When he reached it, he breathed his last Dominarian air. Without pause, he stepped through. He and Hannah embraced for a long time. Then they approached the dais where Urza waited. Once there, Gerard spoke, hissing.
Gotcha. "Release Hannah. Release her whole to me, and I pledge myself to you. I am your servant, Yawgmoth."
He's like, "It's got to be solid form, bud. I can't take anything less."
Yeah.
Back in the throne room of the stronghold, Krovax was participating in a victory dance with Selenia while Erte watched. He did not want to interrupt the Evankar, but he beckoned Krovax to Squee's body. He stopped dancing and approached the body, he and Erte both looking down at it. No longer was Squee's head spattered across the floor. It was solid again. No longer was his body still. Breath slid in and out of his lungs. Krovax's interpretation of this was that it must have been a reward for completing his mission.
"That must be it. Squee is a gift from my labors. A plaything I can kill 100 times each day.
Even as he spoke, the goblin began to cough. He sat up, looking around in confusion. Resuming the dance, Krovac strode right across Squee. He crushed the goblin to the ground. His claws sank into Squee's belly and ripped it open, killing him. Krovac and Selenia continued onward, leaving red footprints.
Jeez.
I like that Krovac is like doing a goofy little happy dance.
Yeah, he's a real, like, he's, he's kind of a neckbeard. So, while the strange display went on, events were unfolding in the skies above Urborg. By that point in the story, Rami Darigaz and the three other primevals had almost reached Urborg. And I'm not sure if I mentioned it earlier, but throughout Darigaz' quest to free the dragon gods, he had, much like Karn, experienced lost memories. And, you guys know why I didn't add that, because I just think stuff like that's boring. So, anyways, that's because he was the fourth primeval the whole time.
Karn?
Yeah, no, the Rami Darigaz.
Oh, sorry. Rami Darigaz.
Karn's just like flapping his arms.
Yeah, it's working.
I don't know what this shit is. Okay, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I don't play the cards.
No, you're the conduit for the audience. You're representing the audience here.
I'm representing every the show. Audience who don't know what the fuck you guys are talking about.
Okay, so yes, Rami Darigaz is the fourth primeval.
Not Karn,
everybody. Disclaimer. Now I know what you're thinking. How could he be the fourth primeval when they found that dragon's body beneath the surface of Shiv?
How? That's what I'm wondering.
Right? That's because it was one of his past bodies, sort of like how a reptile sheds its skin. Darigaz had been reborn thousands of years earlier, forgetting his past life as a god and living as the son of Jerry Darigaz. So it was at that point that the other primevals explained how they were to awaken the final primeval. I'm pretty sure I made a mistake in the last episode. I said like Krosis was the one that they awoke and he was the wormy looking one. That picture was the correct picture of him, but they actually awoke Dromar. And Krosis is the final primeval. I just don't want to, you know, just avoiding any kind of
well, now corrections. I'm confused.
Yeah, of course. I'm kidding. So, how they were going to awaken them, they had to basically kill themselves. And their deaths would, their sacrifice would awaken the final primeval. And then that primeval would resurrect them all. Or Darigaz's like resurrective powers would resurrect them. Anyways, with their combined strength, they would once again rule Dominaria. Needless to say, the free people of Dominaria had more than Phyrexians to worry about. So as they dived into the aforementioned tar pits, only to be reborn more powerful than ever with another dragon to join them, and with that taken care of, they took to the skies where the rest of the dragon nation circled. The skies belonged to them, and they would tolerate no challenge to their mastery. Unfortunately for Skyship Weatherlight, that meant the dragon nation set their sights on her. So the dragons are turning on everybody. Everybody.
Hell yeah. Hashtag dragon nation.
That's
hell
right.
Yeah.
Oh my god, you guys.
Jinx. So it does seem like a change of heart for Darigaz, but you never know what'll happen when one is gifted with unlimited power, right? Anakin Skywalker, anyone? So what followed was a desperate cat and mouse game between the dragons and Weatherlight. Eventually, Darigaz caught up with the Weatherlight and forced himself into the engine room where Karn waited for him. At that point in the story, I was hoping for a showdown between the two ancient creatures, but Karn simply persuaded Darigaz to snap out of his fervent need to evict Weatherlight from the sky by reminding him of their past triumphs together. And he probably talked about old Jerry Darigaz.
And then they probably put their arms around each other and went, "We are
other champion.
Actually, I was thinking of the with that Goo Goo Dolls song. I don't want to win.
That's not a Goo Goo Dolls song. That's the Dawson's Creek theme song.
Well, whatever it is, it's a good song.
You're thinking of, and I don't want the world to see me.
I was thinking about that song, but then I sang the Dawson's Creek song, so I think we got
to
go with that.
I don't
want
to wait for my wife to bend over.
That's an off-color joke.
Oh, no. those aren't accepted on this show.
Because, as I mentioned earlier, Karn had also regained all of his lost memories that had been lost during the events of Bloodlines. Then Karn gently grabbed the dragon's horns, and Darigaz suddenly remembered everything they had been through together.
Aww.
Grab my horns.
It's like a little, dream sequence thing.
I don't like those. I fast forward through those. Like, I legitimately do. I can't. I'm like, I hope we get back to the plot at some point here.
And then now it's, you've got a friend in me is what's playing.
You got a friend in me.
Yeah. Poor Randy Newman. Frolicking together in a field, holding hands.
Holding horns.
And they're holding horns. And they're like, you know, they have a little like play fight and push each other. It's cute.
So into the primeval's mind came an image of a long time ago. He was a young serpent. He flew, wings spread, above Weatherlight. They struggled to escape Sarah's realm as it collapsed around them. Once a home for angels, the place had become a perfect hell. Its mad ruler saw foes everywhere and slew all those she could. Refugees crowded Weatherlight, the final few who could escape. Then the Silver Man spoke into Darigaz's mind.
Once, you would have sacrificed yourself to save another. Now you sacrifice everyone to save yourself.
It's not tight. It's not right.
Corn sad.
The primeval's response sounded hollow.
Altruism is a mortal flaw.
You got a friend in me.
Friend in me. Karn's only response was dragging the dragon god back through the memories of the dragons he'd sacrificed that led to that moment. And just like that, Darigaz turned around and left Weatherlight in peace. He could have caught the air with his wings. He could have saved himself from the volcanic caldera below, but he was no longer interested in saving himself. And just like his mother before him, that's Jerry Darigaz, everybody, Darigaz gave his life defending Dominaria from the tyranny of self-styled gods. And just dived into a volcano.
Wow.
Yeah. Not to be reborn.
No, he's not going to pull a squee.
Mm-mm.
No.
Not this time.
That only happens once per series.
I see.
With his death, the remaining dragon gods were mortal once more. And by that point, Elidamri, Lin Sivi, and their combined army of elves and Keldons had arrived on the hot and spicy shores of Urborg. Mm. Not only that, but remember that army of tree folk equipped with Kavu?
Everybody? How can I forget? Right?
They also rose out of the sea and landed on Urborg, ready to claim the primeval that had been stolen from Yavimea. So just as reinforcements arrived, Commander Grizzlegom was mopping up what was left of Drownu's undead army. The battle had left the Minotaur with a weakened army, so he was pretty thrilled to see Elidamri and his force. But the fight wasn't over. The dead were dead, but the Phyrexians still needed to be dealt with. Their next target, the Stronghold.
Oh.
Many of the Coalition soldiers, including Grizzlegom, Elidamri, and Lin Sivi, took Kavu as their mounts, and they headed for the Phyrexian perimeter around the caldera housing the Evankar's fortress. Meanwhile, Weatherlight was still pursued in the sky above. The primevals were no longer immortal, but that did nothing to dampen their speed or ferocity. Having said that, Weatherlight was successful in killing two of them, not to mention a swath of regular dragons. But it was not enough, and the skyship's engines eventually died. Then Weatherlight crashed behind the Phyrexian perimeter. Not to worry, though, as the remaining dragons now had the Magnagoth treefolk to deal with, and the Phyrexian perimeter was otherwise occupied by Grizzlegom and Elidamri's armies.
All right. Okay.
More than that, Karn, gifted with his full-bellied memories, had discovered how to truly read the Thran Tome and told his crew members
I know what we need to do. I know how we can save the world.
You got it. Ready me. And that's Plane Shift, everybody. A bit of a cliffhanger ending, which is usually the case with a middle book in a trilogy. And
classic middle book.
Yeah, middle book syndrome. Usually the middle book is the best, and that's pretty much never the case with kids.
Aww.
Yeah, isn't that ironic? but then you have those people. Riley. Then you have those people that like Jedi the best. So you never know. It comes down to preference. Well, Riley's not really a middle child because there's four of them.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, there's no middle child
in
that mix.
He's in the middle. He's not one on the
two.
End.
Yes, but he's not the middle. There's two. If we're That's going true. Middle, there's two middles.
There you go.
And I know which middle child. Well. Anyway, we're gonna do Apocalypse next. It is the third and final book in the Invasion cycle, and it's also like the last book in this, you know, the Weatherlight saga, as well as like Urza's story. Not to put too fine a point on it, but it's sort of the end of all these series that we've done over the years.
And our author Bobby.
J. Robert King, he wrote
Bobby
all three.
King.
J. Bobby
short King.
King.
Hashtag Short King.
Hashtag Short King, yeah. No, he wrote all three of them, and so far so good. I mean, you could take it easy with the sexy stuff, but...
Is there sexy stuff?
Well, just some of the way he writes sometimes about, like, volcanoes and things spilling forth. It gets a little sexual. At least that's... Yeah. I mean, we're laughing at it. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
I thought you meant he's writing, like, nice romantic sex scenes. I'm like, why aren't those in here?
Well, there was some of that, in, like, I don't know if you wrote the Retepe book, but him and, like, Retepe right. and Zansha get sexy.
That's right, they do. Yes, I remember you telling us about yeah. that.
So that was, those were nice. Those were nice times.
I can only read books with romance in it. Hmm. Like, I need a romance storyline.
Hmm.
I need sexy times. Can't help it.
That's okay, you know, we all need what we need.
It's like, some people can only watch and read books with violence.
Right. Yeah, that helps, certainly. All right, everybody. Well, thank you for listening, and we'll be back on the next episode covering Apocalypse. And
Apocalypse Now, Apocalypse
Then. We're
going
to do a whole
forever.
Apocalypse series. Yeah, we're going to talk about the hit film Apocalypse Now. And we're going to do that Apocalypto movie that I think Mel Gibson directed. I don't know what it's about, but... We'll check
we'll
it out.
Talk about
I've never
that
seen
other
it.
Movie that's very similar to Apocalypse Now that was released right around the same time as Apocalypse Now.
I don't know what you're talking about. Cool. All right, everybody. Well, just take it easy out there, and we'll talk to you next time. I hope you enjoyed Plane Shift.
Thanks, everybody.